This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second of the showcase sessions at today's collection symposium. My name's Martha Sear, and I'm a senior curator here at the National Museum of Australia. And it's my pleasure to present five speakers to you today. I'll be endeavouring to keep each of them to time and also to keep the question period to the allocated 5 minutes at the end of every paper. But there will be a further 15 minutes at the end of the five papers to continue our conversation about the issues and ideas that they raise. So I just would like to get started with our first speaker. Our first speaker this afternoon is Karen Schamberger. Karen is a colleague of mine, a curator here at the National Museum of Australia, and she's a member of the team that is developing the new Australian Journeys Gallery. As part of her work on the gallery, Karen has developed a research interest in objects produced in displaced persons camps following World War II, and today she'll be speaking about one of those objects, an object that is in the National Historical Collection and that will also feature in the new Australian Journeys Gallery, and that's the Little Red Riding Hood wall hanging. So over to you, Karen.
Before I begin, I'd like to thank Patria Kay and Deb Spoer, two of the conservators here at the National Museum of Australia, for helping me read this object. Many years ago, a wall hanging was given to us, which is a part of wartime history, as the accompanying note explains, wrote Joan Tapp on behalf of the Management Committee of the Forest Hill Residential Kindergarten in November 1990 to the Australian War Memorial. The wall hanging did not fit their collecting guidelines, so the offer was directed to the National Museum of Australia. The NMA was interested because it was brought over by a woman working for the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration after World War II. The woman's name is Valerie Paling. Each time the wall hanging changed hands, it was given. The wall hanging was made by a Ukrainian refugee, Olga Bazilevich, at Neu-Ulm displaced persons camp in Germany in 1946. She gave the wall hanging to Valerie Paling in thanks and appreciation for her work. When Paling returned to Australia, she presented the wall hanging to the Forest Hill Kindergarten, and I quote, "a home in the country for a few weeks for kindergarten children who need special nurture." Unquote. This shows Paling's practical humanitarian side and how she valued the wall hanging. It was then given to the museum when the kindergarten closed in 1990, so the memories of Bazilevich and Paling could be treasured. All we know of Olga Bazilevich is on this wall text, which hung beside the wall hanging at the Forest Hill Kindergarten, and what Bazilevich has woven into the blanket itself, her skill, determination, ingenuity, and generosity. The wall hanging is made from materials she could find and trade cigarettes for. On a standard issue United Nations blanket, she applied fur, scraps of linen, felt, paper, wool, and even a pine cone. Bazilevich migrated to the USA, so to start with, the wall hanging significance was its association with the Australian aid worker, Valerie Paling. However, more recently, it is Bazilevich's story, that of refugee and migrant, that has become most prominent. An example comes in an article in Recollections written by a former curator, Ian McShane. McShane focuses on the analysis of the development of the museum's collection, and the Little Red Riding Hood wall hanging is used as an illustration of the Migrant Heritage Collecting Program, undertaken by Professor Zubritsky and Dr. Kuntz from 1988 to 1990. The caption to the image is as follows: "Quilt or wall hanging featuring Little Red Riding Hood, made by a Ukrainian woman, Olga Bazilevich, in a displaced persons camp in southern Germany, 1946. This quilt, which can be interpreted as a vivid allegory of Nazism, became an innocent wall decoration at a Melbourne kindergarten before donation through the museum's Migrant Heritage Program, unquote. As I noted earlier, the wall hanging was an offer that came to the museum independent of the Migrant Heritage Collecting Program, although it did come at the same time. It was made in a displaced persons camp, like much of the migrant heritage material collected by the museum at that time. For these reasons, perhaps, it has been interpreted as a migrant heritage object. If we go back to the file, the curatorial assessment draws that last similarity, but also notes that this object is particularly interesting as it reflects not only the experiences of those people displaced by war, but also that of Australian officials and relief organisation workers who were working in Europe after the war. Unfortunately, this assessment was also completed in a time when curators were not readily acknowledged on assessments they wrote, nor was it referenced. Therefore, I can't find out why the anonymous curator interpreted the wolf as the Nazis. A brief look at Ukraine's complex and bloody history sees parts of what is now Ukraine occupied by Poland, Russia, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the beginning of the 20th century. Part of Ukraine became one of the founding republics of the USSR in 1922. Various Ukrainian nationalist groups fought for independence between the two world wars. Soviet Ukraine underwent a massive famine in the 1930s, which claimed between 3 and 11 million lives, depending on who you believe. And parts of Ukraine were invaded, ceded, and invaded again by the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, finally being subsumed into the Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War. The vivid allegory of Nazism mentioned in Ian's paper and the assessment is not discounted, but broadened and more complex. Neither the wall text nor the information provided by the donor includes anything about Bazilevich's political views, so the wolf could be representative of all or any of these nations or political groups. Or, alternatively, is it possible that Valerie Paling influenced the representation of Little Red Riding Hood in the wall hanging? The clothing shown on the wall hanging is the English Riding Hood. Was Bazilevich learning English? Did she read or hear the English version of the story in the camp? Maybe even from Paling herself. Bazilevich also uses stump work, an embroidery technique which originated in England, to create a three-dimensional effect for some of the characters and plants, particularly the fly amethyst mushroom and the frog and the wolf in that picture. Paling was a Melbourne school teacher who would have grown up with an English version of the story, and it's possible that she communicated this version at the camps. Whether she knew stump work and embroidery, I've not been able to find out. We may never know why Bazilevich threaded the story of Little Red Riding Hood, or where or who she learnt stump work from, but the wall hanging itself provides some tantalising suggestions. Paling began as a field officer with the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration in 1945. Within a year, she had risen to become a camp director for UNRWA and later for the International Refugee Organisation, responsible for 7,000 people across 7 different camps in southern Germany. A Ukrainian refugee who was a child at Noyom Displaced Persons Camp and migrated to the United States is Roman Voronka, who kindly provided me with this description of Paling. Valerie Paling deeply cared about the fate and welfare of the refugees. In response, she was liked and appreciated. She was presented with little gifts that were especially crafted for her. Voronka's uncle, Roman Zohor, photographed camp life, and in his collection are a number of photographs which include Paling, such as this one taken in Reinhardt Concern, the Ukrainian section of the Noyom Displaced Persons Camp in 1946. the same camp and time period in which Bazilevich made the wall hanging. Valerie Paling is seated in the front row, second from left. This person here. She is holding an embroidered pillow, which was a gift from the group of displaced persons. Mistetsvo, the Ukrainian word for art, is written in the background. According to Veronica, Paling inspired and encouraged the refugees to learn a trade or skill that would prove useful after they migrated to a new country. Those skills included embroidery, sewing, woodwork, and mechanics. The photo shows some of these objects that were made through this process. The wall hanging can be reinterpreted and reassessed within this context. It can still be considered an extension of the NMA's migrant heritage collection, but perhaps with more emphasis placed on Paling's significant role in helping refugees apply for migration to Australia. It is the material remains of not only Olga Bazilevich's experiences of camp life, but also the material evidence of the experiences, memories, and inspiration provided by an Australian aid worker, Valerie Paling. In 1952, she wrote to Roman Veronica's mother, "Have you forgotten Reinhardt and those 6 long years? I don't think you ever will, however hard you try. People, events, conditions, atmosphere of those camps are branded into my brain as if with red hot irons. How much more so in yours?"
Craig Wilcox, thank you, Karen. I'm talking about an evocative object, and evocative in its rejection by the memorial as well as by its acquisition here, because it really highlights the distinction, I think, between what you might call a national military story, the one you get on Anzac Day, and then the collective or family military story that's come down to all of us from all of our relatives.
That is a very interesting thing. I guess at that point in time, I guess the War Memorial was the national collecting institution that was most obvious to the kindergarten at that point in time. I think its acceptance by the National Museum of Australia indicates its focus then on very much on social history. And obviously the War Memorial considered it also to be social history. And it's interesting the demarcation between the two institutions. Okay. I guess most of you would be familiar with the Grimm Brothers story. That's Red Käppchen, or in English translation, Little Red Cap. The German version of the story actually shows Little Red Riding Hood wearing a German cap, which probably comes to about here. That was preceded by another version from France by Charles Perrault. The French version uses the chaperon, which comes down to the shoulders. When those stories were translated into English, Little Red Riding Hood acquired the hood. She originally, if you go back right to the earliest known versions of the story, she did not have a red hood or a red cap or a red chaperon at all. That was an invention by Charles Perrault.
It's a complex.
It's very complex.
Yes. Yeah. Anyone else want to ask a question? No. Thank you, Karen. Join with me. Thank you, Karen.
speaker is Erica Dicker from the Powerhouse Museum. Erica is a curator there. Having had a brief chat with her and a bit of a familiarity with the collection that she's been working with, you could probably classify as a wool classer. If you wanted a career in the shearing shed instead of the storage shed. But Erica's going to talk to us about a collection that she documented in 2007, a really extensive collection of 5,000 wool samples, the Bill Montgomery Wool Collection. And so she's going to tell us a bit more about that project. And please join me in welcoming her today.
Thanks, Martha. It's not often I get a captive audience to talk about the wool collection. My talk will cover the Bill Montgomery Wool Collection and how we used it as a source material, also how new technology can be used on old collections to provide new and unique information. The Bill Montgomery Collection consists of over 7,000 samples. The older part of the collection, there's about 5,000 samples dating from 1856 to 1906. These samples of wool were collected by the museum at a time when scientific research was prominent in the museum's activities. The museum also, as most of you know, in Ultimo, was very near the site of the old Sydney wool sales. So the farmers used to bring their sheep to sale and donate samples to the museum. The honorary wool classer at the time, Alfred Hawkesworth, looked after the collection. So large parts of the museum were dedicated to displaying wool and woolen products, as you can see in this photo. However, this all changed. In 1979, the focus of the museum changed. Wool was no longer considered important, and the collection was given away to Bill Montgomery. Actually, no, I'm not going to say that. The collection wasn't actually given away to Bill Montgomery. The collection was actually thrown out. It was actually put in the garbage bins out the back of the museum. Bill Montgomery stood at the docks of the museum and pleaded with them not to throw it away. He was a wool classing teacher from Newcastle Technical College, and he took the whole collection back to the college in Newcastle and used it to teach with. Upon his retirement, they were going to throw the collection away again. He took it back to his house, kept it in his garage. He couldn't park his car for 15 years. Anyway, the Powerhouse purchased this entire collection back from Bill in 2003, probably giving him the same amount it would cost him in parking for 15 years. And we were able to research it last year with the grant given to us by Australian Wool Innovation. Now, just a bit of background information on the wool industry in Australia. This is Samuel McCackie. He was a pastoralist in the late 1800s in the Riverina area. His property was called Coonong. He purchased it in about 1860. And he was a very influential man. He was also very wealthy. And he started his flock using very high-quality Tasmanian merinos. And he used to experiment with different bloodlines, and he'd give his experiments a year, which in sheep breeding is not a long time. But anyway, he had some luck, and he built this awesome, amazing flock of sheep that everyone wanted to buy, and everyone really trusted that his sheep were the best. So by about 1883, he had one of the most sought-after breeds of sheep in the area. Then he got greedy. He wanted more weight in his wool. He travelled to America and saw a specific type of breed of sheep, the Vermont. And in 1 year, 1886, he ended up bringing back over 500 of these sheep back to his flocks in a bit of a snap judgment. He was quite a hasty man. The villain of the story is the Vermont. I don't know if anyone, if everyone is kind of recognises this sheep, but the Vermont's a breed of sheep from the state of Vermont in America, and they produce huge amounts of wool, mainly due to their heavy wrinkle. As you can see from the photo, their skin's folded, which allows them just to grow a lot more wool than the average plain body sheep that was in Australia at the time. So these are the sheep McCackie brought back. The weight of his wool more than doubled in a few short years. He also became invincible at shows. Remembering he was a very influential man, a lot of the judges at shows at the time were associated personally with McCackie. I'm not saying anything there. But he was so influential that other breeders of plain-bodied sheep gave up. They wouldn't bring their sheep to shows. There was no point. And so people in the area started buying these sheep from McCackie. He ended up influencing about 90% of farmers in Australia introduced this breed of sheep from McCackie's lead. However, there's great debate in Australia about this sheep. As you see from the bottom picture here, that's a plain body merino. The top one's one of Mackaykee's Vermonts. Huge debate raged around the country about these sheep. It was played out in most of the major newspapers in editorial columns and opinion columns through very influential merino farmers, and also the honorary wool classer Alfred Hawkesworth to the museum at the time stated his great disappointment in the Vermont samples that were being donated. So what was this debate about? Well, Mackaykee had obviously invested a lot of time and money into, well, not so much time, money into breeding these Vermonts. However, half the weight of their wool washed out when the wool was washed. It was all due to the grease. So of all folded, the skin folds just produced a lot of greasy wool. But it was at a time in Australia where they just wanted quantity. They were breeding for lots and lots of wool. However, farmers in, they were debating that quality should be put at a foremost over the quantity of wool. Mackaykee didn't give up. He stayed fast to his breed. He'd obviously invested a lot of time. So that's another plain-bodied merino. It's probably one of the... from famous Wanganella Station, who didn't enter into the breeding Vermonts at this time. So Mackaykee didn't give up. He never admitted that his wool was bad quality or that the weight was due to the grease in the sheep. These Vermonts were so badly adapted to the environment, they couldn't withstand the harsh Australian conditions. Their thick skin folds attracted blowflies, and the maggots were unstoppable. It could be seen that they're one of the reasons we have to, the mulesing is done now, because the folds on the back of the sheep had to be cut away. They're also extremely hard to shear. Shearers were referring to them as uneven corrugated iron, and one ram could take up to 2 hours to shear. So Australia suffered a huge drought in 1902, one of the worst this country's ever seen, and it decimated the industry because these sheep just could not withstand the conditions. But Mackaykee never admitted that he was wrong or he'd done wrong, and this breed took years to breed out of the Australian sheep. He eventually, after the drought, he gave up and started breeding plain-bodied sheep once again. Back to the collection. We tested the Bill Montgomery collection using OFTA 2000 technology. It's optical fibre diameter analysis system. It basically tests a piece of wool fibre in 25 seconds for micron, crimp, staple length and comfort factor. So we tested 1,200 of the Bill Montgomery samples, and this new technology proved once and for all that Mackaykee was wrong. The Vermont was quite terrible, and we could discover it in 25 seconds as opposed to years and years. These are some of the samples we pulled out that we had of Mackaykee's sheep that went through the OFTA machine. The bottom ones are unwashed samples and the top ones are washed, and you can quite clearly see the demise as he bred the Vermont more and more into his flock. The wool becomes very, very greasy and extremely coarse at 25.6 microns. So this picture gives a clear evidence of his demise through breeding these sheep. For those who don't know what a normal or a good merino staple looks like, this is part of the museum's collection as well. It's Australian fleece that won Best Fleece in the World in 2003. Nice and light and fluffy and 10.3 microns, extremely fine. So with new technology, it kind of means these breeding disasters can be a thing of the past. During my research on this collection, I also discovered some other secrets in the museum. We have several of these museum stock books where they used to record the original wool samples coming to the museum. This might relate back to using texts as objects. These books are museum objects. Yet they hold vital genetic information, as the farmers used to record the breeding line of their sheep as they donated the sample. I deciphered about 3,000 of these entries. A bit of this one is, Golden Tom 2 by Golden Tom by Treasurer by Golden Tom by Sir Thomas 2 by Old Sir Thomas. It goes on and on and on. Wool historian Charles Massey believes this information is not recorded anywhere else in Australia. Farmers didn't like to admit the secrets of where their sheep had come from. We used this information to create detailed genetic trees, and we could trace all the wool samples in our collection back to 3 stud rams. So the results of all this work were used in the publication The Australian Merino by Charles Massey last year. It was thought to some to be the Bible on the history of the merino. So, that's how we used our wool collection as a source material to help gain a unique insight into the history of a fibre that helped build Australia. But I think wool as an object doesn't speak very well for itself. It's not something people can interpret easily without other information. This is just one story. I think our wool collection may hold many stories. The economy, the environment, agriculture, manufacture techniques. I think it's all just there to be discovered. Thank you.
Thanks. Alessandro Antonello from the Museum and Collections Program at the ANU. I've actually done lots of... my honours thesis was on the Federation drought, and it occurred to me when you showed the full... the series from 1894 through to 1900, the Vermont wool, that was the, you know, is the deterioration of the samples more perhaps due either to the breed or to the prolonged drought, 1895 onwards, of just pathetic seasons? Is the Australian merino wool... did that shape as badly as the Vermont wool? And I think the point you made at the end, that it can shine a light on perhaps environmental history, you know, do wool samples tell us about good seasons and bad seasons, these kinds of things. So one of the uses of material history there.
Yep, absolutely. That's a really good point. And I think it's due to both the Vermont becoming more and more inbred in the flock and definitely the environmental conditions, because the sheep were so badly adapted, the folds got tighter, maybe tighter as it got drier, and the wool just deteriorated into absolute disaster. Other plain body merinos at the time, if you have a look at our samples, they're all online on our collection database, as well as the test results. You can see they stand up. They'd been bred here for years and years before this, and they were very well adapted to the environment.
The statistic is 40 or 50 million sheep died during the drought. Can
19 million.
Yeah. Can we, I suppose that's Eastern Australia, can we, you know, were the majority of Vermonts or...
Majority of Vermonts, yeah.
Eric, I'm fascinated by the story of the collection going into the museum, out of the museum, and then back into the museum.
Yep.
And have you got any more information about, or would you like to reflect on how the decisions were made about what particularly saw the collection being revalued and it being taken in the second time?
From what are revalued, taken in the second time, mainly fueled by our curator of biotechnology, Sandra McEwen, and Charles Massey, who really saw the importance and the value of this collection. And Sandra knew the backstory and that we got rid of it, and she's known where it has been all along and really pushed hard to purchase that collection back from Bill. Bill Montgomery sadly passed away last year as well, so it was one of our last chances to acquire it.
So was it, just following on from that, was it the fact that the collection went through a life cycle of being useful in terms of its the capacity for it to be scientifically analysed at a certain point, became useless in the context of a certain time that wasn't valuing use of the collection as a source for science about Australian wool? And then when the technology changed that allowed for a different apprehension of the collection again in those terms, that's when it came back into prominence? So was it the kind of scientific value all the way through? Or
No, sadly, I don't think so. I think when they got rid of the collection in 79, it may have been a space issue. The museum was then in small buildings in Harris Street, and I know the wool took up a lot, and I think that the one curator at the time was interested in furniture and put his personal preference against keeping the wool. And actually, we didn't reacquire it with the thought of scientifically testing it. That opportunity only came about with the grant we received last year in 2007.
Craig Wilcox is our next speaker. Craig is an independent scholar, and he was with the museum earlier in the year as a visiting fellow. Craig, the book Redcoat Dreaming is nearly finished.
Yes, it
nearly is finished. That's good. And Craig will be talking about one of those red coats that that feature in his book, a particular one worn by a member of the Faithful family while they were in the Volunteer Rifles. And that the collection, the Faithful family collection, is also with the National Museum as part of the Springfield assessment we did.
Other speakers are claiming successful encounters with objects. I'm going to admit to a failed one. I didn't extract useful evidence from a study I made recently, as Martha said, as a visiting fellow here at the National Museum, of the red coat now being used as the icon for this symposium. Now, that might reflect on me, or it might reflect on the particular object. Still, failure can be instructive, or so those of us who fail often tell ourselves. It prompted me to think, then in private, now here in public, about the potential of material history and one danger that I think is inherent in it. Now, as Martha said, the coat was worn by Percy Faithful. He was the eldest son of a prosperous pastoralist. He wore it around the year 1870 as a subaltern in the Volunteer Rifles, a part-time, community-based military force, closer in spirit to today's fire brigades than to our professional army. He left almost no written record of his life in uniform. Almost as scarce are documents on the Volunteer Rifles generally, and on almost any uniforms worn in colonial Australia, whether of their manufacture or import, their fitting or buying. The written evidence that historians are trained to turn to left plenty of silences for this coat to fill, or so I thought when I began my study. I also thought, surely an object so visually eloquent is going to be historically eloquent too. So, what did the coat say? Its cloth, colour and cut are almost identical to those of coats worn by junior officers in the British Army of the day. The silver braid and buttons identify a part-time military force. The buttons are stamped with a horn, a crown and letters VR, which evoke Volunteer Rifles, as well as Victoria Regina. The buttons also bear the name of a British firm and were therefore imported. But there's no label on the coat itself to reveal where or by whom the tailoring was done, let alone where the cloth came from. The coat was cut to fit a tall, thin man who might have grown to fuller girth during its working life, since the chest buttons seem to have been let out a little. Other signs of wear are minimal. The coat's lining and the pocket the lining contains look almost new to me. And there are some stains on the collar which might be from hair oil. Now, all this suggests that the coat wasn't worn for long or during rigorous training, let alone on active service. Slight uncertainty in the silver braid might indicate a tailor or seamstress unfamiliar with sewing an officer's uniform. Now, if it seems a useful picture is emerging of a derivative uniform of an auxiliary military force and a possibly less than committed wearer, let's compare that with what written evidence reveals. The adoption of British red coats via the Volunteer Rifles turns out to be documented, however sporadically and imperfectly, in the pages of Sydney newspapers and in government records. These also suggest why the adoption occurred. The men like it, a colonel said. There's a feeling amongst them that it's associated with actual soldiering. The lack of wear to Percy Faithful's coat proves no surprise. Family papers here at the museum and in the National Library suggest something unserious about the man, a dandy who chose to live on his father's money rather than through his own efforts. Those papers also contain dozens of dance cards, suggesting an unsuspected environment in which the coat might have been seen and, maybe, one reason for using so much hair oil. In any case, Percy Faithful left the Volunteer Rifles soon after his coat was made, a departure confirmed by a resignation letter now hidden away in state archives. That he had little chance to wear out his coat before then is suggested by newspaper reports and memoirs of Volunteer Rifles activities, which affirm how little rigorous drill was done and, when it was, that shooting jackets were usually worn for that kind of thing. Then there's the visual evidence. Photographs, some held by this museum, do more than simply affirm that Percy Faithful was tall and thin. They tell us what he looked like, with his big, serious face and mop of rich hair perched above his beanstalk of a body. An eyewitness drawing which accompanied an article on the Volunteer Rifles in the Illustrated Sydney News conjured up what his coat would have looked like when he wore it. It shows it as part of a full uniform. And its elegant but improbable shape, shows us how contemporaries like to see it, taking us to the aesthetic and martial mindsets which ultimately determined its cut and its colour. When sources like this and the coat itself cover the same points, then, it's these sources which speak louder, which I suspect is true of many objects made in literate societies for public use. Written evidence also speaks, or maybe makes a suggestion, on one point where the coat seems stubbornly mute. Histories of cloth weaving and of the wool industry suggest that European rather than colonial wool was popular for uniforms at the time, and that the weaving was likely to have been done in England. Now, Mike Smith, sitting here quietly in the front row, might be thinking to himself that the stubbornness I'm talking about is in my head, not in the coat. When I was studying the coat, he pointed out that analysing some of its fibres, and we've just heard about the potential of that, could establish whether the wool came from the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. Now, that's worth finding out, sure, but I've just got one caveat. I could be wrong here, but if most red cloth was made for uniforms in England from European wool, then what we'd find out is whether Percy Faithfull's red coat had a typical source or an untypical one. Now, that's useful to know about the coat itself, but of uniforms generally in colonial Australia? Well, unfortunately, no. Written evidence seems silent on where the cloth was made into a coat. The uncertain cuff braid remains, I think, the best indicator of local crafting. At last, you might be thinking, he's using the coat as evidence. But, of course, I'm not doing that. I'm interpreting what I see in a silent object. And I'll mention one example of such an interpretation to say why I'm a little wary of that, indeed why I think it's a danger inherent in material history. Clayton Fredrickson, a good archaeologist, wrote a few years ago about a broken badge from an 1820s British Army headdress that he'd found on Melville Island, north of Darwin. The apparently deliberate removal of part of that headdress badge, Clayton guessed, might have been, he says, a politically charged act of disfigurement by a soldier stationed there who was fed up with garrison duty and with his officers. But it might also have been broken for perfectly mundane reasons. Because we know that soldiers stationed on Melville Island had a rotten time, we're tempted to read this into the material evidence that we find. The silence of an object is a temptation for us to fill that silence with what we know or what we think we know. And things get worse when we start filling it merely with our own opinions. But if an object is silent, it isn't created in silence. Everything we make is a product of our imaginations. Now, we imagine in words, and where an object is made in a literate society for public use, like this coat, some of those words will be written down and some of those words will be preserved, words like those of the colonel who said that a red coat evoked actual soldiering. In one sense, such words are better records than the objects themselves. They're more of a primary source. They tell us what an object's intention was because they gave birth to it. But in one way, of course, an object, despite its silence, will always speak louder than words. It shows us where the intention behind the object fell short. To my mind, the real potential of the material history of literate societies is here, in pointing to precisely where reality took over from imagination. Percy Faithfull's coat tells us, at least in his case, that the full-breasted puffery seen in the newspaper illustrator's mind was largely in the illustrator's mind. That the cuff braid which proclaimed an officer mightn't do so with textbook elegance, and that even expensive hair oil can compromise a young dandy's looks. Thank you.
Thanks, Craig. It's Maria Nugent from National Museum. I was just wondering about the assumption between something visually eloquent then being an assumption that it would be historically eloquent as well, and what that does for objects which are not visually eloquent and therefore you might assume that.
Yeah, that's right. It takes us back to one of the best points, I think, that was raised this morning, that an object like Percy Faithfull's red coat will always attract us, won't it? Even when it's almost mute. Now, there's a good story to Percy Faithfull's red coat, I think, but I haven't told it because I'm talking about what the coat tells us itself. But, we're always going for something, and we're probably going to make that assumption, and we find out to our pain later on, unfortunately. But there is still a visual eloquence of the thing, and I don't want to play that down.
Thank you. Craig. Thank you, Nicholas Brown.
Yeah, thank you.
What struck me about your presentation, and I suppose I've been thinking about a lot in the few sessions that I've been to today, is a certain sense that there is a one-line process of deduction that you're going to take from this document. So, document, material, thing. Yep. We have a coat, therefore we want to find out about the individual who wore that coat, yep. Therefore we want to find out something about the context of that individual's life. And it lets us down on that particular trajectory. But why is that the only kind of question you might seek to ask about that quote, about the coat? Because in some ways the sorts of things that you are and that come out of that image and that you were identifying in the coat as a tailored object itself started to fascinate me. That these coats are individually, they don't get spat out of a machine that makes them all look equally ostentatiously braided, but they're kind of sometimes clumsily braided. And maybe there are distinctions to be made between officers who get their coats made for them at an expensive tailor, officers who get their coats made for them somewhere else. Even in thinking about, well, here is a military uniform. Let's look at it in comparison to other uniforms that might be worn in society at that same time. So it partly depends the silence of the object or the frustration you have with the object, partly depends on the kind of context you want to put it in. And why do we assume that a coat worn by an individual is going to be significant for the story it's going to tell us about the individual rather than something inherent in the notion of a coat as an object of clothing at a particular time?
What a great question. I must say the one thing that's always annoyed me is that Nick Brown is so much smarter than me and so much more articulate. It just really gets to me. But anyway, I'll just stumble through an answer. In fact, in this case, I do look kind of good because when I was investigating the object, the coat, one thing I did want to look at was at the manufacture. I was really interested to try and find out, well, presumably this coat is a one-off. It isn't a coat worn by an ordinary man in the ranks. Even though the ordinary men in the ranks themselves tended to have a bit of money behind them, whether given by a patron or whatever. But anyway, in this case, clearly, you can think of the object as partly an industrial production. It's partly a product of design and ideas about what soldiers should look like at the time and what particularly volunteer rifle soldiers should look like at the time. And it's partly to do with women working until they're almost blind, sewing little braids around people's cuffs, people who earn far more money than they do. And I hope that the coat would somehow lead me in these directions. Now, it may be the case that I simply wasn't imaginative enough, didn't have enough time or whatever, didn't find enough small leads, didn't do the kind of technical analysis, and we've seen the advantages that can come from that. It might simply be a question of failure on all of those fronts. But you're absolutely right. You've got to look at the thing, and again, this takes us back to this morning, all the different ways, all the different paths that an individual object can lead us, and that's, I think, what's so nice about objects and why I'll stubbornly keep on thinking about them even when I get a result like this. Have I just evaded your question? Is that what you're going to tell me?
It always says the power of the brain is in the brain. I mean, just to look at that thing, hey, I always think uniforms are going to have symmetrical, elegantly crafted braid, but here is a coat that doesn't.
Yeah.
It's kind of like all those trained officers and soldiers, some of whom have got good commissions, some of whom are fairly pathetic folks who can't do anything else.
Yeah, and good point.
Some of whom just wear the uniform so they look good on the dance floor.
Yep.
Some of whom,
a really good point, and also taking us off on another trajectory, which is what does someone from my vantage point in history with my training think that cuff braid should look like? Now we're really getting into the details, aren't we? But of course, I'm after 100 years of industrial production. I expect it to be perfect, don't I? But Percy Faithful might have had no such expectation.
Might have thought that's good enough.
Yeah, or even that's great. Who knows?
Hi, Richard Gillespie. I'm not sure about New South Wales, but I know with Victorian volunteer regiments, there were very, very precise rules as to what you could wear, depending on whether you were in the rifles or the torpedo corps or the armed cavalry or whatever category, and also then whether you were a private or a gunner or an NCO or a major, etc. No different from any other military context, of course. I mean, so in a sense, irrespective of the individual meaning for Percy Faithful of that coat, that coat was meant to declare things to everybody else, and it was meant to, and it had very presumably had very precise messages that told you about his rank, whether it was a dress code, the particular social context in which it should be worn. My understanding, certainly with the Victorian ones, is that there were quite strict orders as to how you were meant to put together, and how a uniform maker would have those orders to apply in each of the individual contexts. So, dare I say it, there may be written records that would help sort of, you know, piece together some of that, some of the underlying assumptions.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the point comes out to be even better than you might have suspected, in that the men themselves vote on these things. They saw themselves as citizens more than as soldiers, and it was, and they were doing their own thing with their own time, was often largely with their own money. So therefore, well, we get to choose the uniform as well. As also they elected their officers, I should say. And so yes, they do sometimes talk about this. But what's interesting is that in the early 1860s, newspapers reported those debates sometimes about what you'd wear and what the distinctions between ranks would be at great length. After 5 years, the newspapers are bored. They're not interested in that anymore. But again, that tells us something. Thanks, Martha. Yep, thank you.
Thanks, Craig. Our next speaker is Matthew Churchward from Museum Victoria. Matthew has worked as a curator of engineering and transport at Museum Victoria since 1994. He's been particularly interested in exploring the way that local creativity and adaptation has affected Australian mining, manufacturing and transport technologies. And today he's going to speak about a remarkable set of mining technology models that were commissioned in Victoria from the late 1850s. So please welcome Matthew.
Good afternoon, everyone. In my case study here this afternoon, I want to touch on some aspects of a remarkable series of models built by a Swedish-born miner and artisan, Carl Nordström, which document in detail Victorian gold mining technology of the late 1850s. Nordström had arrived in Victoria amongst the first wave of overseas gold seekers in 1852 and spent the next 5 years mining at Ballarat. He would later recall that he began building models as a pastime in his tent on wet days and odd hours. Key to this story is this man, Frederick McCoy, who in 1854 was appointed Foundation Professor of Natural Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Arriving in Port Phillip on the Clipper, champion of the seas in Boxing Day 1854, McCoy wasted no time in immersing himself in the scientific and cultural life of the young city. He began championing the need to establish a museum of zoological, geological and paleontological specimens at the university. And in December 1857, he was appointed as the first director of the National Museum of Victoria, a position he would fill in addition to his ongoing academic role until his death in 1899. Over the next 15 years, from 1857 that was, McCoy was to build a mining collection of international significance comparable to the collections of leading mining schools and museums in Britain and Europe. His stated aim was to create a didactic collection to impart practical knowledge to eager, unskilled new chums arriving in Melbourne en route to the diggings and to enlighten the curious public. He collected examples of typical mining tools and equipment and commissioned drawings and models. In May 1856, McCoy was appointed to the chair of the Victorian Mining Commission, established in the wake of the Eureka Uprising. It was through this role that McCoy was able to secure the funding to commission a series of models depicting various aspects of mining on the Victorian goldfields. McCoy was introduced to Nordström through Henry Smith, a mining engineer whom he met when the commission visited Ballarat. In August 1857, Smith wrote to McCoy saying, "I have seen the modeller about whom we conversed when last I had the pleasure to meet you, and he is willing to make a model of a shaft with drives complete, windlass, etc., etc., with figures in wax, correctly coloured. The model would be about 20 pounds, and it will take him about 8 weeks to complete." So began a wonderful creative partnership lasting over 2 years, during which Nordström made 10 detailed scale models that were put on display at the National Museum in the university grounds. Nordström's first model for McCoy depicts a claim on the gravel pits lead at Ballarat, showing a cross-section of a 20-metre deep shaft, underground tunnels known as drives, and surface installations. Nordström faithfully incorporated typical timbering of the shaft lining and details of the wooden surface structures, including a windlass, a hand-cranked mechanical ventilator, and the holding paddock used to store wash dirt waiting to be cradled. Like all of the Nordström models, this one includes figures, in this case underground, we can't see them here. Nordström fashioned his figures from wire frames wrapped with fabric and dipped in hot candle wax. The miners' hats and hand tools were made out of thin lead sheeting. Though somewhat crude in their facial expressions, the figures make Nordstrom's models unique within the museum's extensive collection of mining models. They help to provide a social context and bring the models to life, and have been the key means of enabling generations of young museum visitors to engage with the models. Following completion of the Gravel Pits model in September 1857, McCoy asked Nordstrom to make a model of a deeper claim operated by a horse whim on the Blacklead at Buninyong. Here, Nordstrom had to half the scale in order to show the whole 40-metre deep shaft. But he also produced two supplementary models showing at a larger scale details of the underground drives and the horse whim. Once again, his attention to detail is superb, showing here a traditional Cornish miner's legless barrow, complete with iron axle fittings and an iron tyre shrunk around the wooden wheel to reduce wear. Above the barrow hangs a beautifully fashioned pair of blacksmith's tongs. After building six models for the Mining Commission in just over 9 months, McCoy seems to have become increasingly ambitious, inquiring through Smith if Nordstrom could build a series of three larger models depicting the main types of alluvial mining then practiced in Victoria: surfacing, shallow sinking and deep leads. This, the second of the three models, depicts miners working shallow alluvial drifts at Daisy Hill near Maryborough in central Victoria. With these larger models, Nordstrom was able for the first time to include something of the environmental context of Victorian mining, showing bare denuded hills, silt-choked waterways, as well as something of the feverish scene of activity both above and below ground. Here, Nordstrom's practical mining experience and acute sense of observation really came to the fore. In the contract specification, McCoy had asked for the model to include, quote, several shafts with whip and all kinds of windlass with between 50 and 60 figures. Nordstrom obliged, showing a hillside peppered with 30 shafts, each equipped with subtly different designs of winding gear, creating a unique historical record of the range of windlass and whip designs found on the Victorian goldfields, from crude structures fashioned of forked tree branches to skilled tradesman-built models with carefully carpentered timber and blacksmith-forged iron fittings. For the first time also, Nordstrom began to use the scope of these larger models to incorporate little vignettes telling individual narratives. Here at the right, this one down here, he depicts a miner injured by the partial collapse of the roof of an underground tunnel being rescued by his mate, while overhead a new chum unbeknowingly is sinking a shaft into worked out ground. Undoubtedly, however, the piece de resistance among Nordstrom's models is this large depiction of the Port Phillip and Colonial Company's works at Clunes, built over 5 months from August to December 1858, at a cost of £215, over twice Nordstrom's initial quote. To supplement the alluvial mining models, McCoy wanted to commission a model showing the most up-to-date quartz mining techniques. The natural choice was Victoria's largest quartz mine at Clunes, a pioneer of large-scale scientifically run mining. Floated in London in 1852, the Port Phillip and Colonial Gold Mining Company was the first foreign-owned company to invest in Victorian gold mining. After initially spending several frustrating years trying to obtain an alluvial mining lease on Crown land, the company turned its attention to several promising quartz reefs outcropping on private land at Clunes, and on the 1st of January 1857 signed a 21-year lease with the landholders. While the company concentrated on establishing the large treatment works, shown here in the foreground, to crush quartz and extract the gold, it arranged for a cooperative party of miners to operate the mine and deliver a guaranteed minimum 50 tonnes of ore per day for treatment. Nordstrom built the model on location at the mine, living in a tent on site, and was assisted by the managing director, Rivett Bland, and the company's engineering staff in perfecting details of the machinery and underground works. Wanting to show the whole operations of a large mining complex that sprawled over several acres, he decided to depict all surface installations and machinery at the same scale of 1 in 32, but cleverly reduced the distances between features, compressing them more closely together while still maintaining a realistic feel. Beneath the hillside, at the rear, he showed details of underground workings, faithfully reproducing the timbering and stoking techniques used in the actual mine at the time. For the technically minded mining historian like myself, the model incorporates a wealth of detail about machinery that is either not mentioned or barely touched on in written descriptions of the mine. The original treatment plant at Clunes was based on centuries-old Cornish mining technology, traditionally used to process tin and copper ores, but the company also drew on mining and metallurgical experience from around the world. The treatment plant depicted in the model had been constructed progressively over an 18-month period from January 1857 to May 1858 and comprised 44 stampers in total, arranged in four units. Under the direction of Joseph Robson, the company's battery manager, the treatment plant underwent a series of rapid modifications and innovations during the early years of the mine's life. If we take a moment here now and get my cursor up, hopefully you can see it on the screen, I just want to zoom in detail on some of the stamp batteries and have a little bit of a look at some of the evidence of these early experiments, which is clearly depicted in the model. Here, the number four battery shows iron strips. Along here, fitted to the wooden stems of the stampers to reduce wear, and iron bands to reduce maintenance, iron bands around the wooden cam barrels to reduce the maintenance headache created by cracking in the revolving wooden barrels. The second battery here, slightly earlier, number three battery, has no iron strips on the stamper stems, and even more iron hoops on the cam barrel, probably evidence of slightly longer use. While the number two battery, next in line, if we look in detail, we can see it's actually fitted with a cast iron cam barrel designed by Robson. By 1864, the company's stamp batteries had been completely transformed, with all moving parts being replaced with iron to reduce maintenance costs and increase ore throughput. Another remarkable feature of the model is the fact that while written accounts describe each of the five steam engines only in general terms, Nordstrom has modelled them in such detail that makes it possible to even determine the makes and models of the engines. Here, this cursor going on, this engine down here. Here it's possible to identify a Ruston Proctor twin-cylinder portable engine driving the Chilean Mill and water pumps, identifiable by the distinctive winged brass maker's plate on the back end. While driving this stamp battery here, is a patent Clayton and Shuttleworth steam engine. The model was a triumph for Nordstrom when first exhibited in Melbourne in early February 1859 and so impressed a reporter from the Argus that he described it as unsurpassed in boldness of design, minuteness of detail and beauty of execution. Shortly afterwards, in June 1859, Nordstrom left Victoria, sailing on the One Eden for Southampton. In the decades since, the Nordstrom model now held by Museum, the Nordstrom models, sorry, now held by Museum Victoria, have continued to create joy and fascination for succeeding generations of museum visitors. Their significance relates not only to the accessible way they depict typical Victorian mining practices of the 1850s, but also to the accurate record they provide of early Victorian mining technology, including details not readily gleaned from other written accounts, photographs, or etchings.
Thanks very much, Matthew. That was a great presentation. Can you tell us briefly a little bit about the materials used? For example, the landform, is that plaster or paper mache and clay, etc.?
All of the models sort of had bulk to them, were typically built out of wooden frames. The wood appears to be just recycled packing crates and various other timber at hand. And then they were covered with a wire mesh, a bit like chicken wire, and then covered with plaster of Paris to sort of get the landscape texture. A lot of the timber is just, the wood that they're made of was obviously materials readily at hand. Most of the what would have been metal components in the original machinery he seems to have made out of metal, although probably not the same metals as the actual components. So he used a lot of, for example, lead that was very and zinc, which were very easy to fashion to create what were, for all intents and purposes, iron components.
Thank you, Matthew, very much for that. I love those models and always have. A quick question, it hadn't occurred to me before, but looking at them and listening to you, I wondered, was McCoy responding to something about museums that he'd brought with him from Britain, or can we credit him with beginning the tradition of dioramas in museums, do you think?
That's a really interesting question, and probably warrants some more research. It's hard to know exactly who came up with the idea of building this sort of diorama-type models. Clearly McCoy understood that in what he was commissioning, because you can see in the specifications he writes, but preceding the written specifications, there was a number of discussions between him and Henry Smith, and also with Carl Nordstrom. And I believe, although I haven't been able to verify this, that Nordstrom had built a number of models himself earlier than that, which I think had this sort of landscape quality to them as well. So the idea may have come from Carl Nordstrom and been adopted by McCoy, or it may have been something that McCoy developed himself. It's clearly, though, quite different to a lot of the other models in the mining collection and the sort of models that would have been a lot of European mining collectors at that time, which were very much more didactic, and they were just simple pieces of technology or equipment.
Our final speaker today is Ian Coates, who is a senior curator in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program here at the National Museum. Ian's written and researched extensively on the history of collecting and the display of Indigenous cultural material, and today he's going to be talking about the Australian Inland Mission's Frontier Fate and Exhibition, which was held at the Sydney Town Hall in 1928. So over to you, Ian.
I'd just like to say that in this presentation there'll be some terminology for Aboriginal people that's of its time and certainly not the terms that we would use now. But we'll just go with that. We've probably all been to a fete, but how many of us think of them as sites of representation? And how do they differ from more conventional sites of representation like museums? Well, this is a story about fetes. In early 1928, sisters Sherlock and Grimason, two nurses from the Australian Inland Mission's Birdsville Nursing Home, wrote to the organisers of the 1928 AIM Frontier Fete and Exhibition. "We are sending down a parcel for your wonderful fair. We are sending two boomerangs and a letter. Curiosities are few and far between in this district. It's been so dry and all the blacks have moved through the fence and no one seems to have anything to send. In the early part of the 20th century, the Presbyterian Church and its Australian Inland Mission, or AIM, had a well-established tradition of holding fetes, stunts, exhibitions and other events as a way of promoting the work of the AIM, educating its patrons and raising funds. And my paper examines the materiality that survived from one such event, and I focus on its implications for broadening our understanding of the acquisition and display of Australian Indigenous material by non-Indigenous institutions. The nurse's letter highlights their quandary about the process of self-representation from the heart of Australia. It also points to the crucial but ambiguous role of Indigenous people in the collation of material for this exhibition. There's much to untangle here, but in the time available, I want to propose that this collection, the exhibition it stems from, and the relationships it is implicated in, illustrate two important points. Firstly, that this exhibition provides a very different model of representation, and secondly, it points to another model of Indigenous collector relations, one which differs from the usual Indigenous maker and non-Indigenous collector model so often represented in museum collections. But firstly, some background about the AIM and this collection. The collection is derived from the activities of the Presbyterian Church's Australian Inland Mission. This organisation was established in 1912 by the Presbyterian Church of South Australia. The AIM is inextricably linked with the life and work of Reverend John Flynn, and the organisation was the result of his 1911 proposal for the Presbyterian Church to establish an agency which would provide a, quote, mantle of safety, unquote, for non-Indigenous Australians living in remote locations. This entailed providing for both the spiritual and physical care of these people. By the 1920s, the AIM had established a network of nursing homes in remote parts of Australia. The AIM had also went on to pioneer the use of wireless communication and the development of the Aerial Medical Service, the forerunner of the Royal Flying Doctor Service. The Presbyterian Church had set up the AIM to be a self-funded organisation. Thus, throughout all of their activities, there was a great emphasis on fundraising and related promotion. And Flynn was very much at the cutting edge of promotional techniques. He was a keen photographer and made extensive use of lantern slide presentations to bring an image of the inland to metropolitan audiences. And you can interpret the exhibition that I'm going to talk about as an extension of such promotional activities. As I indicated earlier, the place of Indigenous people in Flynn's vision was ambiguous. In the 1920s, the Presbyterian Church was running Aboriginal missions at Arakoon and Mapoon and would later establish missions at Ernabella and Kamanya. Flynn saw the AIM as specifically directed towards non-Indigenous people's needs, with the welfare of Indigenous people already catered for by other parts of the church. In practice, this meant that Aboriginal people were treated as outpatients at AIM hospitals, but they were not admitted as inpatients until the 1930s. However, from the objects sent into the 1928 AIM exhibition and the surviving related correspondence, it's clear that remote-based AIM staff frequently drew on Indigenous objects in selecting material to represent their region, and that many of these AIM nursing homes were enmeshed in complex relationships with local Indigenous communities. I want to turn now to have a quick look at what the collection actually is. The collection arose out of exhibition organiser Andrew Barber's call to remote-based AIM staff to send in objects which, quote, will give the city dweller an opportunity of visualising more clearly the conditions of inland Australia. A broad canvas indeed. The resulting museum collection of about 100 items can be viewed as having three interrelated dimensions, and those are that the objects actually contained in the collection, the places from which it originated, and the event at which they were displayed. In terms of objects, the collection is a diverse and eclectic range of material. It includes Indigenous objects, botanical samples, modified wood products such as turnbowls and cups, samples of different animal skins and hides, fossils and mineral samples. The collection also contains some of the original exhibition labels. It's a collection which defies easy classification into the familiar modes of ethnographic, natural history, and or social history. In terms of places, the collection originates from the actions of AIM staff, principally women, at nursing homes in different parts of Australia. In this respect, the collection serves as an index of AIM's reach into inland Australia at that time. I want to turn now to the third dimension embedded in the collection, the event of the Frontier Phaeton exhibition. And there's two parts to this event. Firstly, there's the three-day fete held in Sydney in April 1928. And secondly, there's all the preceding activity at the various nursing homes which lead up to that fete. Despite the visual impact of such events for visitors, as historians, it's difficult to retrieve an understanding of what was obviously something of an immersive experience. However, we get a feel of the fete from some contemporary descriptions. And here the witness writes that, quote, Barber had assembled all kinds of interesting specimens and curios ranging from buffalo horns to precious stones, a number of which were forwarded by our sisters and outpost ministers. The scheme of decoration of the hall was effective, representing the Australian bush, each stall having the walls covered with tea tree bark and gum tips, with wild flowers such as flannel flowers, waratahs, Christmas bells, butterflies in amongst the greenery. Although a distinct and bounded event, it's important to understand that the fete and exhibition was related to other AIM activities. Indeed, it occurred during a peak of activity of AIM. For example, it was at this occasion, this fete, where John Flynn, I think, first publicly launched the concept of the Aerial Medical Service, which was the antecedent of the Royal Flying Doctor Service. And it occurred at a time when there was a huge public interest in the AIM and Flynn's ambitions for the inland, and precedes the publication of Eon Idris's enormously popular Flynn of the Inland. The reports of sisters Baker and Thurston from Port Hedland Nursing Home reveal something of the texture of the activities involved in creating these localised representations in the different nursing homes. Quote, we're trying our best to find curios for your fete in April. There are not a great many things of interest around Headland, and any we have are much too large to send. And then later they followed up by saying, we're sending you along some curios next boat, Our black boy is busy making a box for them. He arrived home with a huge packing case on his shoulder, begged it from the local grocer. So if you see a large parcel arriving from Headlamp, don't think it's a fat sheep or kangaroo we are sending you. Sister Thurston suggested sending her, covered in sandfly and mosquito bites. Wish we could send a few of our pests over. I intended sending the parcel for the fate this mail, but I know the patient coming tomorrow will have some more exhibits. I do hope the fate will be a success. I'm writing to friends of mine in Sydney telling them to go along. And in there we see all the processes of how they're getting the material together, that we're seeing the communication between the AOM staff and the Sydney-based AOM staff. The box of curios that they refer to included a large number of objects, including many Aboriginal objects such as spears, boomerangs and a dried crocodile skin. However, the nurse's letter also makes clear how the role of Indigenous people in the formation of this collection goes well beyond simply being represented via collected ethnographic material. The role and representation of Indigenous people takes a further turn if we examine the material sent from the Victoria River Downs nursing home by sisters Dora Norman and Bessie Wood. Out of a range of objects spanning crocodile skins, bird flowers, headbands, a number of knitted dilly bags are of particular interest. They're accompanied by a label which reads, "Dilly bag made by Lubras of Victoria River Downs with needles and thread." These bags, a traditional form but made from non-traditional, colourful wool, have much in common with the knitted goods made and displayed at the fete by the Sydney-based AIM supporters in other parts of the fete. Indeed, I would argue that these string bags, made in VRD, can be interpreted as women's handicrafts rather than as ethnographic specimens. And it's that kind of repositioning of that material that really allows us, I think, the possibility of material coming out of very different contexts of acquisition to the sort of standard ethnographic material. Well, in closing, I'd like to suggest that it's useful to examine the role of objects and collections and examine the role objects and collections play in the establishment and growth of relationships. In the case of the Frontier Fete and Exhibition, these relationships were principally between remote-based AIM staff, metropolitan-based AIM staff, and metropolitan-based AIM patrons visiting the exhibition, and then also the ambiguous role of Indigenous people. To return to my suggestion at the beginning, the analysis of this eclectic collection and its display offers the potential to illustrate a very different representational rationale for the display of Indigenous objects. And I think it's one radically different from the usual one, which sort of focuses on social progress. It is one which arises from the AIM endeavours to connect the remote to the metropolitan. And in this aspect, a reading of that exhibition, you can see that it's actually got more in common with Traeger's Hedda Wireless and the Aerial Medical Service than in fact it has with other types of exhibitions. In fact, they're all, the exhibition, the radio and the Aerial Medical Service, they're all about technologies of connection, connecting the remote to the metropolitan. And I'll leave it there.
Danielle Wickman, I'm a student with the Museums and Collections School at course at ANU. White Australians today are accused of appropriating Aboriginal culture to represent ourselves overseas. This seems to me to be quite an early example of that same sort of impulse. These remote white Australians are appropriating Aboriginal items to show how they're different to people in the cities. Is that an interpretation that you also see? And is it particularly early? Does it happen earlier than that as well?
I think I'm trying to argue a slightly different interpretation, that the engagement of the AIM staff in those remote locations is a lot more sophisticated than just trying to appropriate Indigenous representations. I mean, they're looking around their community and going, what defines this region? And I think also with the knitted bags, you can actually, and of course we can do this in the absence of any evidence that supports this, but one can actually start to speculate about, you know, were they created in collaboration with those nurses? You know, was that a sort of shared activity? So rather than just a simple appropriation, I think there's actually scope in this collection to see a much more sophisticated reading of people's engagement in those sort of frontier situations at that time. And I should also say that I think it's a range of material that's rarely held in museum collections, because it's the rationale for it is very different to the rationale that was driving museums at that time, which was to sort of have representative samples of Aboriginal artefacts from different regions, whereas this wasn't. Or wasn't it wasn't, but yeah.
Nicholas Ganeen, thank you. Well, I was just really going to, it's not a question, it's an observation, but it builds on that same point, because in the absence of actually being able to get very close at the exhibits themselves, what struck me about the assemblage of stuff there was it really didn't seem to be about appropriation at all. It seemed to be about an attempt to give a sense of commonality in space, that these are the kinds of resources, handicrafts, geological specimens, whatever, that occur in our experience. And there didn't seem to be that sense of here we are working with the natives in a barbarous land trying to do something for the name of God. It seemed to be a very integrated sense of, I'm not sure what, but it's the not sure whatedness which was fascinating about your presentation, because this is not the way we usually think about people presenting their mission to Indigenous Australians.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, you're right. I mean, there's a very much a developing body of literature around mission collections, and that puts a lot of stress on the collection of material demonstrating the evangelical success of missionary activities. This is very different, partly because the AOM is a bit different anyway, but it throws up different body material. I mean, for example, I mean, one of the real highlights in this collection, I think, is a goat skin from Moolaboola Aboriginal Station in Western Australia, which was, you know, one of the first stations set up as a pastoral station for Aboriginal people, and they were, you know, trying to domesticate goats. I can't imagine that you would have that kind of object in a museum collection from any other source, really.
Fred Morris, I thought it was very interesting, if I'm wrong, you basically described the AIM as fundamentally ministering to whites at a distance. And in a certain sense, the Aboriginal objects are collected with sandflies and pests. I mean, they're really not the object of this. They're kind of the local color of distance and remoteness, neither good nor bad, but simply present. But how does the AIM collections compare with, say, what came from other Presbyterian missions, which are very shortly, I mean, in the 30s, right? They start to...
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a good question, and this is going to be pure speculation, but I think it would be... it would depend on what the collection was for. I mean, there was certainly arts and crafts manufacture going on at a number of missions, and so material acquired that way would be, you know, sort of tourist handicrafts thing. But if it was a collection, if it had been an earlier collection coming out of mission like that, I think it would be much more about, well, for example, similar to some of the material that comes off, say, the Lutheran missions, you know, where it's much more representative, whereas this is not a representative collection in any means.
Yeah, just as the warm-up act for the panel, Ian, the material that you showed, was that material left over that wasn't sold at the fete? What is...
Yeah, that's
is it possible that there's lots of other stuff
so many
that
questions,
we don't see?
So few answers. I suspect that they weren't selling this material, but then some of that turned wooden stuff, you know, starts to fall into a different category. So I can't really... I wouldn't like to say this is the material that didn't sell, okay, if that's what you're asking.
Can I invite questions to any of the speakers or to the speakers' panel generally?
Hi, I'm Sandra Robjohns. As a history student, I'm interested in the idea of accessibility, because I think that's a huge issue with this physical object, is actually as a student accessing objects. And I just wondered if you had views about that. For instance, the mining models, I imagine that would be really useful to a number of historians, but it's actually being able to access the things. And another observation was we're discussing primary objects, but nobody brought any primary objects today. And we're in a museum, and it's just interesting that everything has been seen visually today rather than actually seeing the object.
I'll start off because you did mention the mining models in particular. Of course, these models are 150 years old now, so they're extremely fragile. but we did, in 2001, we actually travelled the Clunes mining model back up to Clunes for the sequicentenary of gold discovery at Clunes. And it was a very successful sort of community event. I was very in favour of it. Unfortunate result of that, as a result of that, some damage was done to the model, although it was probably fairly minor in the context of other damage done over 150 years. And I think probably the benefit to the local community in having that model back for a short period of time possibly outweighed the minor damage. In terms of accessing these objects, in terms of Museum Victoria, like most of our collections, we try where we can to provide access for general researchers. That includes students, both undergraduate and postgraduate students. But of course, you know, resources are pretty tight, so it all comes down to who's got the time and you know, the amount of time you can put in. And often they need to be sort of supervised access.
Which is that we did actually bring an object here, which is you're sitting in it. In that the actual museum is an artefact of representation, so it's not as though it's a neutral space.
But I suppose I jump in and say that one of the reasons that we're talking here, one of the reasons that we enjoy these objects so much is that they are one-offs, and we're the lucky ones who get to see them, and we get to talk about them, we get to ponder them. If we're really lucky, if the conservators are good to us, we get to touch them, which is fantastic. But it's part of living in a world where so much is reproduced so endlessly, so often, almost mind-bogglingly. And we're talking about things which are pretty rare, pretty spectacular, pretty unusual. It's probably why we're drawn to them. So as much as we might talk about accessibility, we're probably secretly happy that they're not so accessible.
Question here in the centre.
Thank you. Louise Hamby from ANU. Ian, I think this question's really mainly for you, but anyone else wants to contribute, that would be great. I was interested in your sort of ending portion about repositioning ethnographic objects into another category, and I think you mentioned women's crafts for the looped bag from the wool. I just wondered if you'd like to elaborate a little bit more on that, but also in relation to that specific looped bag, it is interesting that you hypothesise that maybe this is a result of classes, if you would like, you know, working with Aboriginal women or, you know, working together using wool or whatever, because those same kind of objects appear in other places, you know, quite different from there, and I don't think they were the result of that kind of activity. I think that was from a different sort of reason. So just a bit more about how you think you could reposition them from that particular exhibition.
I was trying to suggest a move away from simply thinking about artefacts as being ethnographic, and I guess in that is a critique of the concept of the ethnographic, in that it's a concept that once an object is ascribed as being ethnographic, it's almost stripped of its history. You know, it just is. It's representative of a particular type, of a particular place. And I guess really what I'm looking to do is to reassociate those objects with their histories. And so whether it's a history of it being developed in collaboration with that staff at that station, or whether we try and re-inscribe those objects as coming from particular people, just trying to break away a bit from the sort of standard, ethnographic artefacts, yep, that's an Aboriginal object, yep, that's from that place, we understand all that. Just trying to disrupt that slightly is what I was trying to do. But, you know, look, I would welcome your thoughts, probably not now, but about how that bag might relate to other examples that you're aware of. That would be very interesting to explore.
Matthew, up the back.
Okay, thanks very much. Just a brief response to that first question about why we haven't got any objects here today. I did consider bringing some of those snowy objects along, but I didn't for two reasons. Firstly, there is a process involved in bringing objects in, and that does put quite a workload on our registration staff, who are extremely busy out at Mitchell at the moment. Secondly, I think an expanded image of these sometimes small objects on the screen is a better way of showing them to a large audience like this, because you have a, you know, that Chifley model down the front. It's a wonderful thing when you can see it close up, but for most of us here today, it would just be a little blob. So, yes, it is great to have real objects, but for those practical reasons, it's not always possible.
Any other questions? I suppose I'd like to just build on a theme that seems to run through many of the papers, which was that the evidence that came from understanding the, like doing a materials analysis, understanding at that level of what the object is made of, that helps us to further understand its meaning and significance. I just wondered whether the panel or, and perhaps the audience might like to reflect on ways in which a collaboration with our conservation team members within museums. There are a wide range of people within a museum who have something to offer when it comes to understanding objects as evidence, and I just wondered whether the panel might reflect on their experiences of working with those, conservators or other specialists, and what are ways that we can facilitate and encourage that kind of collaborative approach to understanding material culture within our collections.
I suppose, I mean, just taking up on my suggestion to Louise, I think in terms of the string bags from VRD, there's an obvious opportunity to look at the actual knitting techniques and things like that, and really tease out those kinds of relationships. But, I mean, imagine there's also the work you did on the coat.
Yes, that's true. Not that I have the expertise, but conservators have phenomenal expertise here, and just their way of looking at things is so impressive. The best thing I've ever read about uniforms, and I'm ashamed to say I've been reading about uniforms since I was a kid. There's something very odd about me. But easily the best thing I've read was by two Canadian conservators who metaphorically pulled a uniform apart to work out exactly how it was made. It was just wonderful because it told you so much about the person themselves in an indirect way.
Are there any conservators in the audience who'd like to speak about their experience of engaging with objects in this way? Mark?
Well, Mark Henderson, I work at the National Museum as a conservator. I suppose one of the great things is that one always gets to touch objects, which is probably more than many other people. I've always found that working with curators is quite stimulating because obviously as a conservator we're looking at the condition of the object and trying to maintain it as best as possible. And with curatorial involvement it brings a whole spectrum and a whole dimensionality to looking at things. I can't think of an example to describe. Recently, of course, we've prepared the Papunya exhibition of paintings, and it's been very interesting for us to look at the paint systems and all of these features, and also the features that are unique to where the paintings have come from. So I don't know if that gives you a slight sort of insight into what it's like to do such work. But I think on behalf of all my workmates, collaboration is really important between us and other areas.
I must say that I worked with Mark on the Papunya project, and as a curator involved in that show, sort of working with Mark, the conservators are looking at things much closer up and more within the grain of the work, I guess, and whereas as a curator you're often dealing with the concept of the work in some ways rather than the actual artwork. And so when you actually engage with a conservator over that material, you're actually drawn much more into the work and you gain a much greater appreciation of the work through that collaboration, I must say.
A little bit to the sort of discussion here. One thing that sort of strikes me, I think, with a lot of these social history collections is we don't do a lot of really scientific analytical analysis. I think the little bit that we do often is in the context of conservation work when we're trying to determine what something's made of and therefore we can work out how to treat it. I was really impressed with Erica's talk about that research with the wool samples and how you could actually bring modern scientific methods to understand more about objects. I mean, I, for example, have often thought I'd love to find out a bit more about some of the timbers, for example, Nordstrom used in his models or other artefacts that I've been working with. And if only I had access to a scientist who could tell me what species these timbers came from. And perhaps there's some actual opportunities there. And I know in archaeology they do these things a lot more. And we're perhaps not accessing the right experts and the right sort of techniques. There's probably a lot more to be discovered there. Although the converse of that is sometimes it doesn't perhaps tell you much. And I know I liked Craig's example also about he could have analysed the fabric of the coat, but probably it wouldn't have told him much because it's just a coat and you have to have the context. But perhaps if you went and looked at all the colonial military uniforms in Australian museums that have survived and analysed them all as a collaborative project, that would be really interesting, I think. Yeah.
Just one final question from Graham.
Well, it's just a contribution to this discussion about interpreters and conservators. I recently had a very fascinating afternoon at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, where, thanks to Kevin Fuster, I was shown the horological collection. And I discovered when I was there that, in fact, the conservators and the historians are one and the same. The same people who maintain the clocks are the people who do the interpretation. So they're highly proficient historians of science who also know how to maintain these extremely delicate objects. And they would argue that the two processes are absolutely intrinsically joined. Mm. To be able to understand the science and understand the mechanics and to know how the materials are to be looked after are all one and the same process. And struck me as perhaps, I don't think the same process will apply in every context, but it was a principle that I thought was perhaps worth at least thinking about in other museum contexts.
Thank you. We might finish up there. Can I thank our speakers? Can I thank you, the audience, for your participation?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.